Hi, my name is Christine Morgan, and I want to thank Craig for inviting me to give a talk. I don't often get to talk in front of pedologists and mineralogists, and I have to say they make me a little more nervous than soil physicists, primarily because I want you guys to get something out of this, and certainly when you're trying to give a comprehensive talk like this, you tend to track toward what you know. And I know we've done a lot of work in this area, primarily because I'm very interested in verdisols and alfasols because of their effect on hydrology, and I find them both challenging in different ways. So I hope at the end of this talk you leave with some perspective of how the Gulf Coast soils of Texas vary, but also how what this means to the hydrology of the area and our understanding or lack of understanding of the hydrology. So here we start with the same geologic map that David Weindorf started with, and essentially I'm east of I-35, so if you take the light green to orange line and go south and east, you're dealing with the area that I'm going to talk about today. So it's mostly fairly young soils, and they've been deposited by the regression of the Gulf of Mexico. So I realized after I put this slide up, I was looking at it yesterday, I kind of take for granted that this is published, but I can't remember where, so there's no citation. This is from Tom Hallmark, and I think every piece of note or book that I have around the fifth floor heap has this just like crammed into it as a note to remind you how the parent material is laid down here. And so you can imagine, I need a pointer. On the left-hand side, we're in the older material. Oh, thank you. On the left-hand side, we're in the older material, and as we move towards the Gulf of Mexico, of course, we're in younger material. But the interesting thing about this is that, of course, depending on what was being eroded or deposited at the time, depends on the texture of our soil. So we can have a wide variety of texture and hence weathering processes that are occurring. I'll call it the faraway side, the side furthest from the Gulf of Mexico. We have the Wilcox Chorizo and the Cook Mountain Sparta Queen City deposits, and they're quite sandy. And the thing you have to recognize when we talk about these coastal plain sediments, in Bryan College Station area, we have to be careful because this is our residuum, right? But generally, when you learn about residuum and you're not from the coastal plains, you think about consolidated bedrock. But these coastal plain sediments are weakly consolidated. So it can be very hard for novices to look at the soil and determine the difference between old alluvium, which we have quite a bit of, and the coastal plain sediments, which are considered residuum. And these are, again, weakly consolidated. So you can get to quite young material as you get into shales and even the Yewa. And in parts of the Yewa, the sandstone is almost even unconsolidated. So it's kind of interesting teaching soil science in this area. You can imagine we can move towards the Gulf and not move very far and see very different parent materials. And then also this whole Gulf Coast area is dissected by the Brazos River and other large rivers. And so we have, like in the Brazos, we have up to five terraces, which we call the old alluvium, and then the floodplain material as well. So this is a great place to put on a soil judging contest. Not that I'm advertising. Also, the thing about Texas, they're all shutting down officially this year, but we have a lot of open lignite mines going on in Texas. So there's a lot of land mining of coal and lignite. It's really, really dirty, but we burn it anyway. Interestingly enough, just recently they've announced the shutdown of all of them. So we'll see if the regulators will allow it. But I think, you know, everything's now going to fracking. The other interesting thing here is we're always talking about recharge to the groundwater. In this part of Texas, a lot of the water sources are from recharge. And without knowing the geology, you can imagine these really sandy Cook Mountain formation and these sands here will allow for a lot of recharge. But when the water goes in, it kind of follows that area. So you can be over here over the Yewa and put in a well and be pulling water out of another formation. And so that also kind of comes into the local social politics of the area. But primarily, if you look at this list here, we're dealing with alfasols and verdisols. And we have mollusols, and I don't know how many Texans are in here, but our mollusols are weak. They're very much what David Weindorf said. It just depends on, you know, how bright the sun is and how clean your color book is. So if we go back to a more precise geology map, I just wanted, again, like, to brag, because I told you this would be full of Texas hyperbole. But anyway, Bryan College Station is right around here, and so when we want to show students soils, I can just drive very short distances, and we have a really big variety of soils, plus the five terraces of the Brazos River. So we're talking about a lot of variability in a very small area. So first thing I'm going to talk about are alfasols, and we love our alfasols. This is not quite the I-35 corridor, but essentially this is a slide one of my master's students made a few years ago. We were looking at how many where are the alfasols mapped, or the argillic horizons really is what we were interested in Texas, and how many of those argillic horizons have abrupt changes in texture. And so if we're looking at East Texas, quite a lot of argillic horizons. And then it doesn't show up really well, but the grays are abrupt textural changes. And when I say abrupt, I'm talking, you know, abrupt, real abrupt, a centimeter or less, depending on if you have your glasses on. And so here's an example of some of those. This is further East Texas, but we have the, and by the way, all these photos were sent to me by John Wiedenfeld, but he didn't tell me who took them. So I have no acknowledgments other than most of my pictures are from the NRCS, and I think they're just kind of handed down, and some from Larry Wilding. So first we have the Kirbyville, and I didn't really organize myself geographically. I organized myself by, you know, pretty ones, ones that attracted my eye, because I thought this was beautiful with the tonguing of the E horizon. So the Kirbyville is a fine, loamy, siliceous, semi-active, thermic, oxyaquic paleodolt. So we're talking East Texas, we're in the ultisols, and I always love this. As a hydrologist, I get really excited when I see these kind of redox features and the reticulations, because these soils are really cool. When you look at them and you break them open, they have this beautiful prismatic structure, right? And you pull a prism out, and the whole outside of the prism is glayed, like really glayed. And then you pop it open, and there's bits of reds, or in this example, oranges. And those are the soils I learned soil science on. So when I went to Wisconsin, you could see why when I went into soil physics, everything I wanted to do had to do with soil structure and the movement of water around soil structure, because I just seen like, this is what it's about. So anyway, that's my excuse. The other soil here I thought was really cool, Anahuac. It's fine smectitic, thermic, oxyaquic, glossed off. And that's a little bit further south in west of the Kirbyville. But again, I just loved it. You could see, you know, your nice A horizon formation, a second A, probably this has been plowed. You can see the nice sandy plowed layer. And then we have our E before we get into our argillic horizon. I took the Maybank picture. I love Maybank. This is about around Bryan College Station. And this is actually an old alluvial terrace. We still have the clay pan, which we call that abrupt textural horizon is where we refer to our clay pans. Maybank, probably before it got plowed up really well, was a beautiful soil, but you can see the breaking here, the platy structure right above, and it probably isn't actually platy structure. I can't recall. I did describe the soil, but I think primarily what you're seeing is just the drying of the sand above that abrupt textural change. And the cool thing about Maybank is we have these class of soils that we just call hard setting. And what it is they're high in sodium. So when they're wet, they're beautiful and they're dark and they're soft and they're easy to dig in. And then once they reach a certain moisture content, they become concrete. And so the nice terminology is hard setting soils, and then other people just call them the concrete soils. But anyway, it's very misleading when they're moist, because you don't see that. So I had to do two more clay pans because they kind of set me up for, I got to move into hydrology, guys. This is the Robco, and this actually was photographed by Jason Ackerson, a graduate student. I had him go clean this up for a mineralogy tour one time, and he took this picture, and I use it a lot. Because again, you can see this reticulation, it's gorgeous. And this is a Padina sand. This is the soil I lived on, I grew up on, and it's deep, very, very deep sandy mantle again, the Hardulic horizon. And this is taken, this is a photo in a publication by Stephen Ayer out of Baylor. And I want to talk a little bit more about these soils because it's really neat. So one of the best pedology papers, or one I use teaching a lot that I really enjoy, is this one by Stephen Ayer out of Baylor. Because when we have soil judges and soil judging coaches come into Bryan College Station area and we start showing them our clay pans, the first thing they'd start to generally think is, oh, these are two different parent materials. There's no way you can have this sand sheet over an abrupt textural change and then these sandy clay argillics. Literally, this soil here is a sand over a sandy clay. And it is hard to imagine that that's not a lithologic discontinuity. And of course, Larry Wilding and Tom Hallmark have always had all their ideas. And the nice thing is that Stephen Ayer and Stephen Dries and Lee Nort kind of put it together into a beautiful publication where they looked at these alpha sols at different time gradients from south to east Texas. And what the question was is, do these clay pan soils with abrupt boundaries have two parent materials, and do they have a lithologic discontinuity, aka the same thing? I just did a little translation in case some soil physics friends were here. But anyway, and so they tested this hypothesis very, well, I think very nicely. So first of all, here's the description of the padina, and here's the particle size distribution. So we have sand and the clay content, and you can see this abrupt change, right? So what they did is looked at the clay-free particle size distribution. So when you remove the clay and you look at the total sand and the medium plus fine sand, all the different sand size fractions, they found no evidence of a lithologic discontinuity. In other words, the clay-free sand and silt size fractions were uniform with depth, which indicates that these soils probably had, there's no evidence that these soils come from a different parent material. And they also looked at the titanium and zirconium, and there was no big change in them. Though I noticed today when I was looking at this talk that the one slide, I figured there was a break here. And I do remember that they talked about that in the publication, but generally all the other pedons they looked at did not have that. And they had a good reason for that, but I cannot remember what it was. But essentially, then what they did is they also looked at the fine clay fraction, and we know the fine clay is what moves and shows weathering. And again, they showed an increase in fine clay fraction in the argillic horizon. So it was a nice paper, and then they also had a discussion of landscapes. But really, the preponderance of evidence was saying that this is not two different parent materials. So we can stay the clay pan and proudly hold our heads up high. But the other interesting thing about these soils is, like I said, it's sand over clay. And I got a weird call one day that I'm glad I picked up the phone, because sometimes I don't, that these guys were calling me from Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, and they said, hey, we'd like you to look at our land surface models and see if we could improve them with soil knowledge. And we started looking at them, and we realized these land surface models, these are the models that drive the global circulation models, right? And a lot of other, you know, global ecosystem land systems models. Essentially, these are the drivers that partition the latent and sensible heat. So energy comes in from the sun, it either warms things up or evaporates water, right? And that's the latent and sensible heat partitioning, and it's kind of important. Okay, so we'll stop there with modeling. But the interesting thing is this assumes that even though it has the CONUS soil database, the default that 22,000 users run is they say it's got a uniform soil texture and we're just going to take the surface texture. And we thought, I wonder what that does. So we did some modeling. But the first thing we did is with our Wharf Kim group over in NOAA, and we went ahead and coupled NOAA, this land surface model, with what they'll call Wharf-Kim, but it's a weather predictor and it looks at ozone predictions. This is what politician number crunchers count to see what effects of policy would be. And the effect they were looking at were lawnmower rules for Dallas-Fort Worth. It's very interesting how soil science has its tentacles and everything. But anyway, we were just looking at, okay, what if we get the water what if we get water content wrong? What happens to ozone? And what we find, I keep forgetting to put the ozone limits here, but essentially what we find is if we get the water content wrong, the difference can be between dangerously high ozone and safe ozone levels. So it's important to get the water right. The soilies, we know that, but sometimes you have to prove it to the atmospheric chemists. So we found some areas where we had a lot of water content information in East Texas on one of these perfect clay pan soils. And if we took a better model, by the way, we used RZWQM, and we did the homogeneous assumption that NOAA makes, and we did the heterogeneous assumption that we know is there, and we got a much better fit to the water content. Of course, y'all know that. But then we went ahead and took those assumptions back into NOAA, knowing that we were getting a better water content fit, and we just looked at the difference in the partitioning of latent and sensible heat, and we found some huge differences. So the different lines are different scenarios. Just note they're really different, right? And so you can start to come up with different effects of ozone. You can start to come up with different other things, like understanding the non-linear effects of changing climate. And this gets worse as it gets wetter. We did a lot of other studies, but what we found is if you go west, it's not a big deal. The more humid, the bigger the difference in the latent and sensible heat partitioning, which makes sense because you have more water to partition, or more water to absorb energy, which changes the partitioning. So, okay, enough of that. Let's get into vertisols. I like to show mineralogists and petrologists how important their knowledge is. It's really important. And you really need to like step out and talk to people in other disciplines. So that's my like public service comment for the day. But I love this Texas map. Here are the vertic soils of Texas. So you know, like David totally got cut off. He didn't get any of the exciting stuff. So I'm just gonna show y'all pretty pictures of vertisols for the rest of our time. I do wanna make one quick point since this is a mineralogy crew. These are some soils that we did just around Bryan College Station, and we measured the coefficient of linear extensibility. The three soils here to your right are the only real vertisols that we did the coefficient of linear extensibility on. But I love this. This was mapped as a Burleson clay at 0.1, and then we have another Burleson clay at 0.16. And right in the middle, we have a ship's clay, and this is the cool thing. Burleson clay is a smectitic mineralogy, and ship's clay is a mixed mineralogy. It is not dominated by smecta. So, in fact, we've measured higher coal values in ships. We've gotten coal values up to 0.25, which is pretty cool. So it's always a reminder that it's the fine clay fraction, not the mineralogy, that causes shrink soil soils. Okay, enough of that. So this is a pretty picture. This is you can see the Gilgai and the Timnium bowl formation here of this vertisol, but it's very faint, right? So this is a Victoria fine clay. It's got a little sodium in it. And you can see there's a micro high and there's a micro low. Can everyone see that? Thank you for the curtain closer. We probably couldn't have seen that with the curtains open. And then here's the other extreme. This is a little further south, closer to the Gulf. And this is a picture by Wes Miller, and it's very famous in my life anyway. And this is a Pledger. You can still see the old stratifications here. Pledger's a floodplain soil. But isn't that groovy? Those are the bowls and the chimneys. It's completely different. And it's due to the wetting cycles. This soil is wetting and drying more extremely than the Victoria. Well, that's what I'll tell you anyway. And this is another beautiful picture of by Wes. This actually made the cover of Soil Survey Horizons 1 year. And this is, again, Wes's Gilgai. That's a good picture. And this is the subsurface of that same spot after they dug it up. See the slicken sides? Beautiful slicken sides coming out classically at 45-degree angles. And we have a micro chimney and bowl formation, very classical. Thank you, Wes. But the other cool thing that Wes did, now we're like shifting back over to hydrology, and this is crazy. To this day, I told Wes he's crazy. But Wes took a 10-by-10 meter area and measured the cracks over 10 years. And he like got down on his hands and knees and measured these cracks. Here's his 10 meter plot, and it's all to scale, and it's color coded by crack width and depth. Who does that anymore? He even like colored in ant mounds. And so I can't remember how many sheets we have, but 10 years of crack data. And Wes, I'm just started at Texas A&M, another phone call. I'm Wes Miller, and blah. I said, bring your sheets over. Let's see what you got. And I couldn't believe it. And I thought, okay, we got to do something with this. And so we did. We did some really neat stuff. We thought, this is it. This is going to answer all of our questions about cracks. No. So here's Wes's data digitized and made into some format that we can start analyzing it. And here's his crack areas, and we've broken it down by micro highs, micro lows, and micro slopes. And so this is the tail, this is the small end on the left-hand side. But you can definitely tell, first answer the first question, where do the cracks occur? Come on, this end. Micro highs, micro lows, or micro slopes? Micro highs, good. Okay, then we're like, that's okay, first question answered. Next question is, when do they occur and why do they occur, right? Everyone's saying, why do cracks occur?
Drought.
Water content.
Right.
Water content. Okay, and so then we looked at below normal and above normal years, and what do you see here? Above normal is the red. When are the cracks occurring?
Above.
In above normal years, above normal precipitation years. And so that's kind of interesting. So then we take these, Wes, being the amazing man that he is, also took soil moisture content with his crack data. And so we looked at Wes's crack data, and we plotted soil moisture content. We separated micro highs and micro lows. We looked at line density, area density. We came up with every calculation you can imagine to describe cracks and found no relationship between water content and cracks. Yeah, it was great. It's like, oh, this is a tenure maker, right? And so then we had some other, so Andrea is going nuts by this time, and she's just coming up with like, okay, let's look at drying versus wetting cycles. Maybe there's a relationship. Let's look at uniform cycles. We did everything, and you can see, I mean, it's just, things start to parse out, but not really. We're getting very frustrated. And we're looking at the literature, and there's all sorts of evidence here in the literature that antecedent moisture and past history of wetting and drying is important. So we go, okay, how are we going to do this? And so we get some weather data and we start calculating the PET, and then we come up with a water availability index. So now for this 10-year period, we have this nice, you know, water availability index curve, right? And so I'm looking at that and say, okay, we need wavelets here. So we did some wavelet analysis. So wavelet analysis not only looks at the rise, but looks at the shape of the curves, right? Oh yeah, and we're getting closer. So with WAI, just flat out, we do an antecedent moisture, like 2-week antecedent moisture, and we're starting to get something. And then we do some wavelet analysis. And here, this is time equals zero in the bottom left-hand corner. I'm done. Right here? And then these are wavelets, and these wavelets describe like what is the scale of the averaging or the scale of the behavior of the you know, wetting and drying cycle. And so, and then these numbers tell you that this kind of gives you the ranking of the correlation. And so the most correlated cyclic information is coming about 2 weeks out. Our next most correlated information is coming about 4 months prior to the cracking event. Okay, so you kind of get this, kind of simplifying this. And then, you know, here's another smaller 4-month cycle, right? And then now as we get over here, we're getting further and further from any individual cracking event, and we're changing our time scales. Okay, and then look at this regression. When we use wavelet analysis and we pick these wavelets to describe the cracking behavior, we now have an R squared of 0.8. And that's pretty exciting, considering this data set that we were working with. And so then we come back into more modern time. Wes took those measurements a long time ago. And here's Dr. Neely bowing to the cement gods, because what we decided, we were looking at different ways to measure cracks because we wanted to know more. Wes got us really excited. And Haley found out that if you take Portland cement and you add water and soap to it, it makes it very brittle. And we can pour it down cracks, and we can cut it very easily. So she and Jason Ackerson filled up an area, and we did a lot of other sensing, which I'm not showing you at all today. And then we opened up these cracks just to look at them. And then we also did it in different soils with different streak soil behavior. And this is the last slide I'm going to show you, but it was very interesting. And this gets back to soil structure again. So we found two very distinct behaviors. So here on the y-axis, you're looking at soil depth, and on the x-axis is crack volume, and we have three different soils from a coefficient of linear extensibility of 0.1 to 0.17. But the most interesting thing about that is that 0.17 is on an older terrace, and it had really developed, beautiful soil structure, and the other two, not so much, okay? And so we're looking at your crack area density as we go down in depth, which is just kind of pretty. And then you can see that there's very different amounts of crack volume. And we think as these soils, I say super ripen, because the Dutch talk about ripening soils from the time they're no longer flooded and how they start to ripen and crack better. And I just call this like more ripening. But essentially, we're getting into soils with defined structure, and it's really enhancing that cracking behavior, probably because it's wetting and drying more extremely. So that's it. I do want to thank everyone that contributed to this talk. I was pulling slides from, over a decade of different little experiments and pictures that we had done. So with that, if there are any questions.
We've got time for a couple questions.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the math thing side of things. Curious about, so those unconsolidated sediments that are residual, So like for those other maps, are people going to be making misinterpretations about our lithic horizons that they shouldn't be?
Okay, so these are mapped as CRs a lot of times, yeah. And yeah, it's a big issue because, and I didn't show any of this, but we've done a lot of the LSM modeling with like the grids versus the Sergo and Polaris soil data, and they each are handling the CR material very differently, and it just blows the latent sensible heat partitioning all over the place, and we're not even yet dealing with the fact that CRs are root limiting horizons, and they're not in these areas. So yes, there's roots all in there, and I think it would just be a great, very important thing to figure out is how do we reconcile that and how do we deal with it in our land surface models. And you talk to a land surface modeler on the vegetation side and say, yeah, we do a horrible job of dealing with roots. And I said, well, we're not helping you much with the soil information we're providing either. So there's really important questions here that need to be answered. And pedologists are needed, because hydrologists and atmospheric scientists don't have the skill set to dig into the soil maps and reconcile what's important. Great question.
One more question.
I'm going to put a plug in for if you go to soilexplorer.net, you can see all these maps that Christine and her students made for Texas parent material, soil orders, and calcic.
They're super great maps. Yeah. Thank you. I thought you were going to ask me some question about some soil around some places I should, Brenham, yeah, that I should know about. Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you, Christine.